Poet Lucy Brock Broido is most recently the author of Stay Illusion, a finalist in poetry for the 2013 National Book Award. Her previous collections include Trouble in Mind, The Master Letters, and A Hunger. In 2010, Carcanet brought out her selected poems, Soul Keeping Company and The United Kingdom. She has been the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, two National Endowment for the Arts and Awards, the Witter Binner Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the winner of the Massachusetts Book Award. She is director of poetry in the School of the Arts at Columbia University, where she was the recipient of the Presidential Award for Excellence in Teaching in 2013. She lives in New York City and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we're proud to say that she was a Writing Fellow here in 1982 and 1983. The National Book Awards judge's citation for Stay Illusion said, "Ethereal and yet eerily precise, Stay Illusion is a powerful new book of poems that offers a masterful attention to grief and a compelling empathy for those that remain behind. Trembling with an almost otherworldly language that is at once meticulous and fierce, Brock Broido's poems open up the channels between the living and the dead, allowing for a hypnotic conversation that is as piercing as it is utterly breathtaking." Please join me in welcoming Lucy Brock Broido.
Wow, I am really glad to be here. It's so romantic. I kind of just want to tell stories about Roger Skillings, and I have some really good ones. Stanley Kunitz, who was my teacher and still teaches me to teach all the time. I'm one of his hair girls. We're all from Provincetown. Marie Howe, Sophie Cabot Black, Cleopatra, she's a hair girl. And there's just four of us, but that's a lot. It's a lot of hair. Pardon? Hair tossers, yeah. Okay, I'll just do it once, because I don't do it. Jory Graham thinks she's a hair girl, but not Stanley's. I love her, but I just... I'm sorry. That was a little sibling rivalry. Sorry. When I first met Stanley at Columbia, you know, he never really got his hands on my work. He got his hands on my spirit. And he would say things like, "Provincetown is the next right thing." Or he would guide my life. He was really an amazing creature. And he also told me that everyone would always say no to my work. No, and no, and no, and no. And then one day, someone would say yes. And that happened when I left Columbia. I sent my book to Knopf, and I wanted that little Borzoi dog on the spine. And I waited for 7 years to hear back from them, and everyone said I was out of my mind, which was nothing new. But I waited for that little Borzoi dog, and I remain loyal. The dog, and I. One other, just quick, funny story about Roger was there, and I'm not. This isn't embarrassing to you. It's embarrassing to Alan Dugan, who told me when I got here. By the way, I mean, he was such a scamp and a lovely man, and I don't really know what a scamp is. It's probably very dirty, but I didn't mean it that way. But I lived on Commercial Street in this really romantic apartment that was, you know, seaweed would come up to the third floor, and the stairs were rickety, and my best friend here, whose name was Robin Mack, fell through the stairs. That was her worst fear, and it happened. But we had a party there one night, and Alan, let's say, was a little drunk. And we arrived at the top of the apartment, and I had a fireplace. And to this day, I can only write when I have a fire. I have all kinds of rules and mojo and voodoo, which is why I write so infrequently, because all these things have to align. But so we were settling in, and Dugan said to Stanley, "Oh, don't you just want to run your fingers through her hair?" And Stanley said, "I am not an examiner of hair." Ever the gentleman. And then Dugan told me that he really didn't want me here as a fellow. You might remember that. He didn't approve of my work. But he could tell me that because he came round. I will read some poems. Maybe I've never dedicated a reading, but I'd like to dedicate this to my friend Jason Schinder, who many of you know. The last time I was in Provincetown, Jason was trying, this was home, he was always trying to get home, and he had a night flight and it screwed up and he wound up at my house in Cambridge. And so I said, "Well, I'll drive you up." And I had a brand new little kitten named Nicholas. And we took Nicholas in the car and we drove up here. And he was pretty sick then, but still, you know, very much in the world. And we took my kitten in his little carrier and we went for a walk on the beach in front of his house. And I wish I could remember his exact words, but I said something like, "This will be a very beautiful memory." And he said, "No, I'm remembering it right now." He was like that. This first poem is called "Infinite Riches in the Smallest Room." And it has a couple things in it that I could explain. And the first is to do with the medieval practice of putting various badges on groups of ill thought of people, like harlots and leopards and Jews. And I am an Ashkenazi Jew, and in that ancestry, in this poem, there is one of those badges on the speaker. Fuck the speaker, it is I. Dickinson says, "When I state myself as representative of the verse, it does not mean me, but a supposed person. It's me." And the other thing is, you might know what there's something called locked-in syndrome, which was beautifully written about in The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, also a gorgeous film. And it was written by a man who had this full wild life and was in an accident and he lost everything but the use of his complete mental faculties and one eye, which he could blink. And he worked out with a nurse to an alphabet with this one eye and painstakingly wrote this beautiful book about what it is like to live only in your mind, which for me is the last place I want to live. that was funny that I just said. Infinite riches in the smallest room. Silk spool of the recluse as she confects her eventual mythomania. If it is written down, you can't rescind it. Spoon and pottage bowl, you are starving. Come closer now. What if I were gone and the wind still reeks of hyacinth? What then? Who will I be? A gaudy arrangement of nuclei, an apple-sized gray circle on the tunic of a Jew, preventing more bad biological accidents from breeding in. I have not bred in. Each child still has one lantern inside, lit. May the mother not blow her children out. She says her hair is thinning, thin. The flower bed is black, sumptuous in emptiness. Blue-footed mushrooms line the walkway to my door. I would as soon die as serve them in a salad to the man I love. We lie down in the shape of a gondola. Venice is gorgeous cold. 3 December, unspeakable anxiety about locked-in syndrome, about a fourth world. I cannot presume to say. The violin spider, she has 6 good eyes, arranged in threes. The rims of wounds have wounds as well. Sphinx, small print, you are inscrutable. On the roads, blue thistles, barely visible by night, and by these, you may yet find your way home. I started writing a series of poems called Selected Poem, Collected Poem, Op-Ed, Contributor's Note. I haven't written a posthumous one, but it will come in life, of course. But this one's called Contributor's Note, and it's about, Roger and I were just talking about this sitting in my car of, you know, where writing comes from and how you hold on to it and how you let go. And I told him I take basically 1,000 days, I said 2 years, but it's really, I hit for 1,000 days off between books. And he said, how do you bear it? And I said, oh, that's the easy part. It's the writing I can't bear. It hurts. It's too intense. It takes me 7 or 8 years to finish a book. And anyway, I think it's rude to publish too often. So this is a poem about wanting to write, but not wanting to write what I was given to write about. I think we each only have one thing, what Helen Vendler calls the donné. And it's okay. We have one thing, and we just reinvent it over our lifetimes. And I've gotten over my fear of redundancy, except when I finish a book, and then I think, no more for me. Two things. Best definition of a poem of all time was from a fourth grader in San Diego who said, a poem is an egg with horses in it. And it's true. I know it. I've lived in the egg. I've been the horse, and I have a collection now from many students over the years who have given me various eggs with horses in them, from the literal to the wild. I also had a student at Columbia whose name was Noah Raisman, who it happened that his mother was my 8th grade English teacher in Pittsburgh. So strange. And he was doing a double major. He was a doctor at Columbia Presbyterian in New York, and he was studying to be a hand surgeon. And he showed us all kinds of different ways of being. I mean, he was helplessly romantic about poetry. We tried to fix him of that, but it didn't really take. And he also, I've only had one class that ever required a Heimlich maneuver. Someone was chewing watermelon bubblegum, and he was coughing, and I said, "Are you okay?" I thought he was teasing. And he went, I said, "Are you okay?" And so there was a bartender and a physician. So the bartender did it, though, and went, "Poof," in this huge. But anyway, I just had to tell that story, that poetry is, my darling, a matter of life and death, as Richard Wilbur said. Noah Raisman told me that you only get one hand to work on. They're very precious and rare, and you have to take care of this hand. And that gives me chills even now. And I feel you only, this is sort of me talking about, you only have one horse to, you're only given one horse, that one single thing that you have to say. So it's kind of an address to myself. I call it a factory of autumns. That's my hunting season. I write in the fall only. And contributor's note, what if it is true now? I do not want to speak of that which has been given me to say. See, each four-legged rests his face against the fence's slats and asks no questions. Why or how? How long? How dare you come home from your factory of autumns, your slaughterhouse, weathered and incurious, with your hair bound loosely, not making use of every single part of the horse that was given you? What of his hooves, his mane, his heart, his gait, his cello tail, his joy in finding apples fallen as he built his coat for winter every year? Do you know about the poetry Moo? You do? The Moo? I think I got a little Moo there. It's the best thing you could do for a stranger who blew in out of the cold, you know, that last death-defying hour drive in the night. But the poetry Moo is when you get a little after your poems. Marie Howe provokes them more than any poet I know. Mooing. She doesn't moo, but the moos come because her poems are so humane. This is a slightly inhumane poem, but very human. It's an elegy for my friend Liam Rector, who took his life. And he was a poet, and he was my oldest poetic other. He took time off from his poetry and from directing the writing program at Bennington to go to the Kennedy School at Harvard to study the First Amendment. And just given what's been going on and is probably going on more tonight and even more tomorrow, I thought I would read this because it's called Freedom of Speech. There's a really wonderful word in here that people now think I made up, but Liam made it up. It's called sentimentia, and it's what you need to write poem. It's the odd marriage between sentimentality and dementia, and then you've got it. Freedom of Speech. If my own voice falters, tell them hubris was my way of adoring you. The hollow of the hulk of you, so feverish in life, cut open, reveals 10,000 rags of music in your thoracic cavity. The hands are received bagged, and examination reveals no injury. Winter, then, the body is cold to the touch, unplunderable, kept in its drawer of old world harrowing. Teeth in fair repair. Will you be buried where? Nowhere. Your mouth a globe of gauze and glossolalia, and opening most delft of blue, your heart was a mess, a mob of hoofprints where the skittish colts first learned to stand, catching on to their agility, a shock of freedom, wild-maned. The eyes have hazel irides, and the conjunctivae are pale with hemorrhaging. One lung, smaller, congested with rose smoke, the other filled with a swarm of massive sentimentia. I adore you more. I know the wingspan of your voice. Whole gorgeous flock of harriers cannot be taken down. You would like it now, this snow, this hour, your visitation here tonight, not altogether unexpected. The night laborers, immigrants all, assemble here, aching for to speaking, longing for to work. This is an elegy to Jason Schindler. His name morphed. I change names for people. I think one definition of love is that you keep changing the name of who or what you love. Like if I told you what the names of my cats become from, you know, one's a newborn and his name's Mr. Darcy, but by next year I'll have 52 new names for him. And Jason, maybe his name started as, I mean, I hope I'm not outing him, but like Joseph or something, and then it got to be Jason, and then it got to be Jaybird. Everyone called him Jaybird. And then my name for him was just Bird. So this is called Bird Singing. Then every letter opened was an oyster of possible bad news, pried apart to reveal the imperfect probable pearl of your death. Then urgent messages still affrighted me. Sharp noises caused the birds not yet in flight to fly. Then this was the life of you. All your molecules gathered for your dying off, like mollusks clinging to a great ship's hull. Ceremony of wounds, tinned, tiny swaddled starlings soaked in brine. A bird singing in his wicker cage winds down. Now a trestle table lined with wooden platters, neat with feathered wings of quail tucked in. Until you sever the thing from self, it feels. Thereafter, it belongs to none. You have nothing to be afraid of anymore. Outside Prague, I find you warm among the million small gold bees set loose in April's onion snow. Quietly, quietly, would you sing this back to me out loud? This is called extreme wisteria. And wisteria is a state of mind that I made up. You go in, you know, into the state of wisteria where you're pretty dark and pretty wistful. This poem caused me to start. There's something in here called the abandonarium, and it's the place where you go when you've been left. So I started, I'm still trying to make up other dwellings. It started, Franz Wright started this with a room in the loony bin that he called the nicatorium, the smoking room. And then I came up with the sanctimonium, where you are punished, where you're unbearably self, get over yourself. And then I found a place called the pandemonium, which is where you're put, where there are unbearably adorable newborn pandas that hurt you with their cuteness. And I'm working on some more. I have a trepidarium, which I made up, but obviously it's the place where it explains what it is. But an editor who was interested in the poem couldn't figure it out from the poem. And so he went on a hunt and he found a word, an ancient Latin for some. There was a trepidarium, and it was in ancient, it was like a vomitorium or something. And I was very disappointed because I was so proud of my rooms. There's also the green room in here, which is that room you've all heard about where you go behind stage to fluff yourself, take Ativan, drink water, do whatever itises you have to do. This is sort of written as a case history of a writer, a poet. And there are only two things in it that aren't true. And maybe you can ask me later. The poet Peter Davidson once wrote a review of me. And it was a little snarly, but he said, Brock Broido's single subject is the idea that everything she loves will, perhaps tomorrow, die. And I wrote him a fan letter, and I said, you got it. That's it. So I wrote this poem around that idea. And finally, the idea of extreme wisteria came from someone sending me a video, because I didn't believe that this existed, a sport called extreme ironing. And you can look this up on YouTube, and it exists. I was hysterical from it. What it is are the contestants take baskets of heavily wrinkled clothes to remote, extreme places, steep, dangerous cliffs, the edges, hanging from bridges, and they get the wrinkles out of the clothes, and whoever does it. And the real truth is that the participants are called ironists. And I am one of those, so I just couldn't resist it. This has nothing to do with extreme ironing, but I couldn't resist telling you that idea. I'm an ironist. Extreme wisteria. On abandon, uncalled for, but called forth. The hydrangea of her crushed each year a little more into the atter of herself. Pallid, injured, wild in ecstasy, a throat to come home to, Tupelo. Lemurs in parlors, inconsolable. Parlors of burgundy and sleigh. unseverable fear. Case history, wistful, woke most every afternoon in the green rooms of the abandonarium, beautiful cage, asylum inn. Reckless urges to climb celestial trellises that may or may not have been there. So few wild raspberries, they were countable and triaged out by hand. 10,000 count Egyptian cotton sheets. Intimacy with others, sateen. Extreme hyacinth as evidence. Her single subject, the idea that every single thing she loves will, perhaps tomorrow, die. High editorial illusion of control. Early childhood, measles, scarlet fevers, Cleopatra for most masquerades, gold sandals, broken home, convinced Gould's late last recording of the Goldberg variations was for her. Unusual coalition of early deaths, early middle deaths as well, believed despite all evidence in afterlife, looked hopelessly for corroborating evidence of such. Wisteria, extreme. There was always the murmur, you remember, about going home. I'm going to read three more poems. This one's called Of Ricky Ray Rector, and it's in 11 very small parts. And there was a long piece in The New Yorker in the 90s by a writer named Marshall Frady about this man, Ricky Ray Rector, where Frady talks about the mortal intersection of the fates of an obscure black man who'd been wrongfully convicted of murder named Ricky Ray Rector and the then governor of Arkansas, William Jefferson Clinton. He wrote that even as a child, Ricky Ray was a curiously lost and clouded spirit. In 1981, he was in his 20s, and he shot a family friend who was a policeman. And it really was an accident. And he then put a pistol to his own temple, survived under a chinaberry tree, was rescued, and he survived the wound, but they gave him a full frontal lobotomy. His IQ was 63. And he was sentenced to death for the murder of the policeman. There have only been four presidents I've ever loved, and Clinton's one of them, Obama's one of them. But I think the one thing that Clinton's ever admitted to regretting was that during the New Hampshire primary, when he was still governor, his campaign was staggered by these tabloid allegations, the first of many, of an affair with a woman named Jennifer Flowers. And to deflect that scandal, Clinton flew back to Little Rock, Arkansas, for the final night for the appeal, the last appeal of clemency, and to prove he was tough, said no clemency. The Sixth Amendment states that in order for the accused to be tried at all, he must be capable of meaningfully assisting in his own defense. And moreover, in order for the accused to be subject to the death penalty, he must comprehend, and this is so painful, that he's been sent to death, and then comprehend why. And Ricky Ray Rector, as you'll see in this poem, had no idea even what death was. Finally, there are a lot of guards, real guards notes that are used in the poem. And it's Ricky Ray speaking, and sometimes I'm speaking with him or for him. Of Ricky Ray Rector, 1, Amendment 6. If you expect this story to be intact, then you shouldn't have that faith in faith, not here or in a loping place where Ricky Ray won't be so frightened by the dark in Arkansas. A folk's story of unanswerable griefs, he told me. You will probably not see me anymore after I went home. Already what was left of him was like a barn cat leaving just the heart of it, the offering. 2, Staff Personnel Report, 22 January 1992. Inmate Rector reports guards are setting loose chickens in the holding cell. Pork patty, turnips, jello, muffins, milk, pudding, says saving for just before lights out. This pudding reports assorted characters are peering in his window by the tower's light. Enough of possum and their teeth, the gold shags carpeting, the chinaberry tree back home, inmate making hauling sound. 3, the portable baptistry. For you who was taking this down for him, he is all kind about his feeling for you. You all dressed up like scarecrows, taken down by other birds. In the Polaroid, he is up to his waist in water, plumpened, sitting huge and humped up forward, daisy, grinning wide. This day shall you be with me in paradise. 4, Staff Personnel Report, January 23rd. Inmate glimpses limousine cruising through prison. All those he may be hurt are huddled in the back seat there. 6:46 a.m., howling. 7:07 a.m., howling and dancing in his cell. 8:10 and throughout day, barking while sitting on bunk, began noises with his voice like a dog. Years after her death, he told me, mother visits him at night in her tulip dress, clutching her crocodile pocketbook. 5, on clemency. Miss Flowers, he said, not to worry, I'm still voting for your man, Miss Jennifer. Governor Clinton in his mansion on that last frost night, from time to time, was having a hard time catching breath. Some say you will be sleeping when you die. 6, how cold that ice cream fell going down. Day is my good ice cream, he said. 7, touches hands of his sisters, first time without glass, from Ledger Visitation House, a silver canopy over the enormous elm of him. 8, death watch log, 24 January, 1 steak real done, fried chicken with heavy gravy, brown beans, 3 rolls, Kool-Aid, cherry. And he said, for later, pecan pie, for just after when he would went to sleep. 9, from the other side. Rows of folding chairs unfold, a brood of heavy winter coats settling in assembly for the witnessing like pigeons. Nurse in quiet shoes, attending with sickness bags. Then a streak of gold light visible through the top of chamber where he is. You can hear him helping out. 10, from the other side. Velvety curtains for the viewing room pulled back. Tell them, Pastor Motten, what it was like, the vast bulk of Ricky Ray, still bound in with straps of blue, still breathing, the lump of God's gauze holds in his fist, his heart's green light still fluttering, pie still waiting where he left it there. 11. A lot sees, but only a few knows. I love you, Mother, in your Queen Anne's chair. Geraldo, thank you for your company on TV. Bird of prey, waiting like a hearse outside when I'm alive. A poem for a kitten. It's called For a Snow Leopard in October. Stay, little ounce, here in fleece and leaf with me, in the evermore where swans trembled in the lake around our bed of hay, and morning came each morning like a felt cloak billowing across the most pale sky. It was the color of a steeple disappearing in an old Venetian day, or of a saint tamping the grenadine of his heavy robes before the blessing of the animals. I've heard tell of men who brought great Pyrenees, a borzoi, or some pocket mice, baskets of mourning doves beneath their wicker lids, a chameleon on a leash from the Prussian circuses, and from the farthest Caucasus, some tundra wolves in pairs. In a meadow, I had fallen as deep in sleep as a trilobite in the red clay of the centuries. Even now, just down our winding road, I can hear the children blanketing themselves to sleep in leaves from maple trees. No bad dreams will come to them, I know, because once in the gone ago, I was a lynx as well. Safe as a tiger iris in its silt on the banks of the Euphrates, as you were. Would they take you now from me like Leonardo's sleeve disappearing in the air? And when I woke, I could not wake you, little Sphinx. I could not keep you here with me. Anywhere, I could not bear to let you go. Stay here, in our clouded bed of wind and timothy with me. Lie here with me in snow. And this is the last poem. It's the last I wrote for the book, and it was an accident that almost didn't happen. It has a brilliant title, because it's Kafka's. And I've been in love with this title so long, it's been portable. Like, I'll put it at the top of a page, and it will provoke a poem. Like, yeah, probably every poem in here was once called this title, and then I'll snatch it back and say, no, I want another one. So now I've used it, and it's over, but it's really good. A pygmy marmoset is the tiniest living mammal. You have harnessed yourself ridiculously to this world. Tell the truth, I told me when I couldn't speak. Sorrow's a barbaric art, crude as a Viking ship, or a child who rode a spotted pony to the lake away from summer in the 1930s toward the iron lung of polio. According to the census, I am unmarried and unchurched, the woman in the field dressed only in the sun. Too far gone to halt the Arctic cap's catastrophe, big, beautiful, blubbery white bears each clinging to his one last hunk of ice. I am obliged now to refrain from dying for as long as it is possible. For whom left am I first? We have come to terms with ourself, like a marmoset getting out of her great ape suit. Thank you so much.